Blog Talk Radio.
On point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Hello, we'd like to welcome everybody to the edition of episode On Point. I'm your host, John Al, here with Mr. Ron Edwards.
Hey, good afternoon, John. Beautiful day here in the Twin Cities. Our brother, a lot of function, a lot of activities going on.
Oh, yeah.
Heritage Day, some kind of Heritage Day activities up around the U.S. Post Office on Laurie.
And, that's what people last week.
Out talking in terms of the wonderful things they're going to do. So, you know, this is a period of wonderfulness, if you will. But go ahead.
Another election cycle, another group of promises of how focused they're going to be on the blighted area.
Mr. Edwards.
Yeah, Doc.
Okay, we're live on the air.
All right.
Technical difficulty, and they have corrected that in the studio, and we are now broadcasting live On Point. I'd like to welcome everybody to On Point. Mr. Edwards?
Oh, yeah, gotcha. Go ahead. Follow through. I heard us doing a kind of repeat. I must have had some electronic problems. Yeah, Don, how are you doing today?
I am doing absolutely wonderful today. I just got back in, had a few events going on this morning, and an opportunity to stop over at North High and check out the state of the African-American community.
Yeah, I did, too. I caught the last hour. Yeah, that was interesting. That's what we can say. Some other functions going on, and they had a band and drum and bugle corps up there at the YMCA on Broadway, YMCA and the Minneapolis Urban League doing a joint welcome the children back to school kind of thing, and they had the little youngsters out there with the band and the drums and dancing and et cetera. I think the Reverend Bishop Howell was supposed to have something also today, but I didn't see much action up around Shiloh. Maybe they were up at Henry, because initially their itinerary said they were going to march from Henry down to Shiloh, and maybe that's still going on. Then there was activities at Sabathany, and there was activities at UROC. Boy, we've had a full schedule here in the African-American community.
Yes, there's just a variety of things going on. I had actually got a chance to. I also drove up to Shiloh and didn't see much going on, and I drove past UROC where they had the Cancer Society there doing a presentation and kind of like a fair. And so that looked pretty good. And I got out of North Minneapolis after that. So it was a full day of it this morning.
It's been a busy day. I don't know what the full activities were at the Sabathany confab, but apparently it had something to do with social justice things like that. So as we said, it's been fairly active. Big presentation and good turnout on Thursday on At UROC again, talking in terms of light rail and what will be happening, though there's no clear date of whenever, you know, light rail will get started. But a lot of discussion, a lot of different plans. Boy, you can't hardly keep up with them, you know, 1D1, 1D2, 1D3, 1B5. You know, kind of difficult to keep up with all the plans. This was my sixth meeting. At UROC since January, and basically it was pretty much hearing the same thing. Didn't hear a lot about jobs, though, but I guess that's coming at some point in time. By the way, series of meetings over at DOT, some of the ecumenical and social action groups, I understand, coming in, talking in terms that they'll be able to train people in the African-American community for the multiplicity of jobs that will allegedly merge from these multiple projects that are going on. Of course, these are people that haven't had any history of being involved with job development and training and et cetera, but hey, what the heck.
Yeah, and that has been going on quite a bit. I was fortunate enough to have some meetings this week in the areas of Met Council and MnDOT, and I was told by individuals that we just had someone up here that said they could do exactly what you're saying. And
okay.
I just happened to be shadowing another company that actually did this professionally, and they worked in the diamond mines of the Congo, which was a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week event around the clock, and they laid out plans and things. And so it amazes me that, you know, people are now showing up and putting themselves on the map that they're going to do training and they're going to do monitoring of compliance on different job fronts here in Twin Cities. And it's interesting. And, you know, my question to all these folks, you know, what company are you going to hire, you know? Because you already know that it's not going to happen the correct way. We're going to have some special guests on today. Is that Mr. Patton? Is that you, sir?
I'm here, sir.
Okay, great. Mr. Edwards, today's show, we're going to cover some little bit about we had talked about covering about Officer Jason Anderson and the events going around in Minneapolis, the City Hall and the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, but if you will, Mr. Edwards, I'd like you to set it up and introduce Mr. Mike Patton, who is waiting on hold here, and we'll go from there.
Good to have Mike with us again. Mike was with us about a month ago, right after the indictment of Jason Anderson on federal charges of misconduct. City of Minneapolis has been trying for a period of time since Jason Anderson was, quote-unquote, acquitted, I use the word acquitted, of charges of violating the civil rights of Fong Lee, a young Asian shot and killed by Jason Anderson in July of 2006. And in the last 7 or 8 months, the city of Minneapolis has reversed itself and has indicated that Jason Anderson has gone from being one of the best officers in the history of the Minneapolis Police Department to just a pariah, if you will, just one of the worst guys around. And they've been attempting to fire him, and finally what happened was that allegedly an interview, I'm now being told by reliable sources, an interview that he did, and I thought Mr. Patton would be interested in this, an interview that Jason Anderson did with Robin Lawler of the Civilian Review Authority in July of 2009, about a month and a half after the trial in which an all-white jury here in the federal court in St. Paul, quote-unquote, found him not responsible or complicit or anything else. And apparently he gave a statement to the Civilian Review Authority, and in a copyrighted story in the St. Paul Dispatch a couple days ago, it is now being said that for the first time in the 19-year history of the Civilian Review Authority, based on their recommendation, a Minneapolis police officer has been discharged. Now, there's some confusion here because initially Chief Tim Dolan was saying it was as an outgrowth of an interview with his civilian internal affairs. Minneapolis Police Department's internal affairs had caused this, but then Jason Anderson's attorney, Mark Larson, had already been quoted by the Minneapolis Star and Tribune as saying that information had been suppressed in a series of motions in the federal court in anticipation of the indictment. So Mr. Patton was the attorney of record, did an excellent job as best he could under the circumstances given the jury, but more importantly given the judge. Unfortunately, the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals a month ago indicated that it was going to uphold the decision of the jury, which I found to be rather distasteful at best. But we have Mike with us. Mike, can you kind of fill us in on what's happened here? I mean, what brought about the fall from grace of Jason Anderson, who in that courtroom in May of 2009 was being identified by Jim Moore as the greatest officer in the history of the department?
Well, Mr. Edwards, I contended the moment that trial was over that the least little faux pas by this officer, he was going to be fired. And if you recall, he apparently got in some sort of a domestic issue with his girlfriend at the time, and that was the reason ostensibly that they gave, I believe, at the time for why initially they decided to fire him. Look, the bottom line is what is happening here is all an outcrop of what of the Fong Lee matter. This was clearly, in my opinion, the most embarrassing incident in the history of the department, because you had an unarmed citizen gunned down, shot 8 times, and then you had the additional horrible fact of a gun drop. So it was an incredibly embarrassing matter for the department, and they could have done a competent investigation, just gone belly up and admitted that that's what happened. Look, my contention is they knew right away that this was an unlawful killing. The reason they knew was because of the school video. They never publicly stated that they had those images enhanced, and it's my humble opinion that they would have had to have done that. And once it was discovered that there was no weapon on this young man's hand, they were faced with a very difficult situation because they couldn't tell people publicly that they couldn't find a gun. They never did that. They never made any statement whatsoever about the video. At some point they made some vague contention that you couldn't tell. But this was an incredibly embarrassing matter for them, not only the potential for civil liability, but the image of the department to have something like this happen. I mean, it can't get more egregious than that, to kill an unarmed citizen and then to plant a gun. As I pointed out in my last interview with you gentlemen, it was clear that the gun had to be planted because there was absolutely no trace evidence on the gun. So my point is, when they got the feedback from their own forensic scientists, their own forensic people, three of them, mind you, three of them, that there was no trace evidence on that gun whatsoever, they knew. Dolan had to know that it was an unlawful killing. So
they decided then to ferment, if you will, a series of so-called violations. Mr. Allen, and for our domestic international audiences, one of the policies here in Minneapolis is that no information can be revealed relevant to an internal examination or investigation, be it the Civilian Review Authority or the Internal Affairs Authority, until after all appeals have been exhausted. Also, we've had a policy here for 20 years that if, in fact, I want to get this right because it's so delicate, if it is determined that the allegations against the officer has not been sustained by the investigative entity and the chief has not taken an action, the information cannot be made public. If the issue or the allegations are sustained, they could be made public, but this new feature has come up that it cannot be made public until after all of the appeals and et cetera are exhausted. So what Samuel Reed, the director of the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority, which is under the authority of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, Velma Quarbel, director, in an interview with the St. Paul Dispatch, said he was not at liberty to discuss what were the issues or the prima facie that allowed the Civilian Review Authority Board to recommend the termination of Officer Jason Anderson, which is rather peculiar. But on the other hand, folks have leaked the information that it had to do with a specific category, talking in terms of an officer being untruthful. Is that kind of what you're understanding, Mr. Patton?
Yeah, and I think it's significant, as you pointed out, Mr. Edwards, that this is the first time that they've actually paid attention to what the Civilian Review Board has to say. So the point is, they want this guy out so bad, okay? They want him off the force so bad that they're finally paying attention to feedback from the Civilian Review entity. So I think that shows you how significant that is, that finally they listen. Look, they know he's a bad cop, and they, again, I contended the moment that the trial was over that the least little faux pas that this guy did, they were going to get rid of him. I said that at the time. And, you know, I think people are seeing as time goes on that everything we contended at the time of that trial was reasonable, it was rational, it was supported by the evidence. I mean, like you said, here's a guy at the time of the trial was the greatest human being ever born, and ever since then they've done everything humanly possible to fire him, not only fire him, keep him off the force. I have to note, though, this latest firing, I think this one will hold. I don't think he has a prayer of getting back after this one.
And just, again, Mr. Allen, as an example for our audience, domestic and international, the issue that he is being fired about as pertains to truthfulness or lack of has to do with another offense. He's got quite a few, but it has to do with the beating of a 16-year-old African-American in a northern suburb called Crystal, Minnesota, and which at a particular summer festivity, an arrest was being made. Jason Anderson, who was in civilian clothes, working for the gang task force, though, as the young African-American 16-year-old was being secured, appeared out of nowhere, stomped him in the head. In fact, it was necessary, according to some of the documentation now, for the three officers who were on the scene. There were two Crystal officers and a Hennepin County Sheriff's deputy had to restrain Jason Anderson. But, Mike, let me say this to you that I find just rather interesting, which the first time it happened, it made the city's attorneys cringe, but once they made the political decision that Jason had to go. You have to understand, Mr. Allen, that in July, we were a month and a half after Jason Anderson had been, quote-unquote, exonerated, okay? And he must have been feeling so euphoric and cocky that he decided to go in, sit down with Robin Lawler, who is she's a former police officer out of Toledo, Ohio, by the way, that he decided, Mike, can you believe that, to go in and give a statement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in that statement, it was determined that he lied. He wasn't truthful. This
right.
had to do, though, with the case in Crystal and the beating
right.
of the 16-year-old African-American.
Right. Yeah, and a situation, too, just to make sure your listeners understand this, not only has he been indicted as a result of that situation, which, as I understand it, was based primarily on the testimony of police officers, not Minneapolis Police Department officers, but police officers from other jurisdictions. And he's now being sued. And it was interesting, I think, the timing of his firing appeared to come right on the heels of the public announcement that he was being sued civilly and the department and the city were being sued civilly as a result of that Crystal incident.
Within 48 hours. Again,
right.
Mr. Allen, for our listening audience, it was 48 hours after the papers were filed in the federal district court for the Federal District of Minnesota that the announcement was then made that Jason Anderson was being terminated. And as Mr. Patton has just indicated, isn't that fascinating timing?
Well, it's very fascinating.
Yeah. Mike, anything else? We certainly appreciate you giving us your time on this one.
Yeah, real quickly, I wanted to tell you about some procedural issues on Fong Lee. That case is not over. One of the lawyers who represents Kua Fong Lee in that Toyota accident has gotten involved. I've teamed up with him. And he made a request for en banc review. En banc means full. It's a Latin term. For an en banc review of the Eighth Circuit's opinion, an order issued saying that the court would give consideration to an en banc request. After that order was issued, there was then a second order that came out and said, oh, we made a mistake. No, we've decided we're not going to give a chance for argument on en banc review.
Wow.
So now what's happened is that you can't make that up. That's absolutely true.
Mm.
Now the lawyer, Bob Hilliard, who I've teamed up with, who's really handling the key work on the appellate issues, is in the process, will file a writ of certiorari for review with the United States Supreme Court. Now, that's discretionary. And, it's certainly possible that the court may not agree to hear the case, but it's possible that could happen. So there's the potential that the Fong Lee case could be argued to the United States Supreme Court.
And that's something I certainly hope for, particularly in light of the fact that I had an opportunity to read and study the opinion upholding the decision of the jury in May of 2008 by the three-judge panel. By the way, Mike, just for clarification, when this reversal took place, did the full Eighth Circuit set on that and make that decision, or was this just a three-member panel?
No, I don't know specific. I believe it's just one judge that makes that decision, because what happened was you have to request, you need to make a request for en banc review, and that's not, that if you make the request, it's not by any means a certainty that that request will be granted. But, again, what's strange is an order was issued saying, yes, we will give you the opportunity to present argument for en banc review. And then within, I'd say, 7 days, another order came out and said, oh, time out, sorry, that was a mistake. We've decided we're not going to allow you the opportunity to present argument for en banc review.
That's why I asked the question, was it the three-judge panel, was it the presiding judge of the three-judge panel, or was it the full court?
No.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah,
that's not been reported on by the media here in the 28th.
Yeah, I don't believe so, Mr. Edwards. I believe it's one judge that makes that decision. I don't think it's the three-judge panel, and certainly not the court as a whole. I believe it's a single solitary judge who makes that decision.
Wow.
And, it's just very strange. I mean, you can imagine the shock on Hilliard's. I mean, how can you issue an order saying we're going to give you the opportunity to request en banc review, and then issue an order saying, oh, no, that was, in essence, what it said was that we made a mistake, or a mistake was made. We're not going to give you the opportunity to argue for en banc review. So,
and in layman's terms, Mr. Allen, that is the court reversing itself on a reversal. That is fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, this case has had so many strange developments and so many strange things that have happened, not only, you know, factually but procedurally. It's just been one strange thing after another. And obviously, you know, you never know. The Supreme Court can surprise you on what cases they decide to review. Certainly this case, I think it would be a significant one for them, in the sense that you're talking about the conduct of a police officer, and a decision that would be rendered on this type of a case would have significant precedential effect on police officers and police departments all around the nation.
Yes, it would. And again, Mr. Patton, we certainly here at On Point appreciate you giving us kind of an exclusive, if you will, allowing us exclusivity, because, Mr. Allen, as I've said before, those series of events have not been reported by the legal writers for the Minneapolis Star Tribune or the St. Paul Dispatch. And this is obviously, Mike, it's been going on for about 20 days?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah, and I have talked to a reporter. I've talked to a reporter with the St. Paul paper. They know about it. I'm not, you know, I don't want to say anything critical about the media about this, but like I say, there will be the filing of a writ of certiorari, and there will be a request that this particular case be reviewed by the United States Supreme Court. Obviously, I'm hopeful that will be granted.
Right, okay. Mr. Allen, you have anything on Mr. Patton? We don't hold him up. We appreciate him for the time and the exclusive.
No, I'd just like to say I appreciate it, Mr. Patton, coming on today, and you come on anytime and give us updates on this, and I think it was great. Thank you.
Well,
Mike,
I enjoyed speaking with you gentlemen before, and I always look forward to these interviews. They're very very enjoyable for me. So,
all right. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was Minneapolis attorney Michael Patton, who is representing the family of Fong Lee.
Mr. Elm, I have to tell you on some a personal editorial commentary. That is unbelievable. What Mr. Patton just shared with us that happened within the Eighth Circuit, and I would call our attention back to the column I wrote in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder 4 weeks ago, in which we raised the question about what we as a layperson saw as a significant judicial error by the court in indicating that there was certain information that was made available to the court that had to, if in existence, which never came up at trial, had to show Jason Anderson actually shooting Fong Lee to death. And also that video would have shown the planting of the gun.
Oh, yeah.
Seems like that we're more on point, if you will, on that particular particular matter and scenario than we even imagine. I have to tell you, on a personal note, I'm just absolutely taken back by the Eighth Circuit reversing itself on a reverse.
Yeah, and Mr. Edwards, one of the things we're going to do here a little bit later in the show, I hope we can get to, is review some events within the city of Minneapolis and bring in the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights and connect the dots with this.
Absolutely.
This is a scandal that's been going on for a while. This is no conspiracy theory. This is factual. documented evidence on things that are going on, and I would like to actually present a letter that I received from the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights later on in the show. We also have a special guest, Mr. Edwards, Mr. Lenny Chisholm, who was down in Washington, D.C. last week for the Congressional Black Caucus gathering, and he's ready to come on the air right now and kind of give us an update on that.
All right. Welcome, Mr. Chisholm. Come on, sir.
Well, thank you for having me on again, guys. I always appreciate coming on your show. It's an enlightening moment to tell the people about what's going on around here. Yes, I was down in the Congressional Black Caucus, and we saw some exciting things happen now. We got a chance to meet with the U.S. Congress Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, headed by Congressman Oberstar out of Minnesota, to talk about the issues of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And we were joined by the representative from the National Black Chamber of Commerce and also the National Association of Minority Contractors.
Okay. This was facilitated by Congressman Keith Ellison, or who facilitated for you?
Well, Springboard, the nonprofit, requested the meeting after compiling the data for 10 years from the information provided by the Federal Highway Administration in Minnesota. We wanted to sit down and talk with them about how the Department of Transportation of Minnesota could then give out nearly $6 billion and less than 1% of all of that in the last 10 years go to minorities.
Okay.
And still be considered and doing an effective job with the spreading of the wealth of these contracts under the Civil Rights Act. And we wanted to know what the process was for basically ruling the Department of Transportation for Minnesota in non-compliance, meaning that you cannot receive the money anymore for your program, for any parts of your program, for failing to ensure that all people can participate who are taxpayers.
Now,
and that's what we went down
in the last a couple days, Mr. Chisholm. I have seen a very sophisticated document that apparently was put together by your group, which I mean it. We don't have the time, obviously, here on point. Maybe at a particular point in time in the next 24 hours, Mr. Allen can put it up on our respective websites and et cetera. But it has some troubling numbers with respect to allocations by DOT, Minnesota Department of Transportation, and the absence of allocation of dollars for projects, contracts, and et cetera, to communities of color, and particularly African Americans. Could you just enlighten us a little bit about this this specific document? It says, how do we reconcile the disparity of Minnesota DOT minority DBE participation? Could you just enlighten us? Because this is an excellent document. Well done.
Well, what we wanted to do, and I thank you for commenting on the document, what we wanted to do was analyze just how much money was actually granted for the Department of Transportation from the federal government. We thought that was a baseline for beginning the conversation. We've not been able to, over the years, get the actual numbers of how much money is coming in. You know, you go in the room and they'll say, well, we're in compliance. And we say, well, tell us how much money came in, and we start asking the normal questions. Through the Freedom of Information Act, and also just from willingness, we were able to get how much money is coming
30.
In. And the total amount that's come in the last 10 years has been $6 billion, rounded off a million or two from the numbers we've gotten.
Mm-hmm.
Of those numbers, and once again, it's troubling when you only see that of $6 billion, African-American contractors have gotten less than $10 million of $6 billion in the last 10 years. So that would average out to less than $1 million a year. Well, if you take that even farther and you say, well, how much did all minorities get? You know, you look at Hispanics, you look at Native Americans, Asian Americans, and that number comes down to only $45 million out of $6 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, well, how can a program be run properly under the Civil Rights Department when the Civil Rights Department of the program has probably made more money than all the recipients in the program. And that was the basis that we created the document.
Well, let me just do this again for our listening audience and international audience specifically, particularly in light of some of the very sophisticated and academic types of studies that have been done about the disparity, not only in contracts and et cetera, but jobs. The percentage that Mr. Chisholm has just made reference to for the years 2001 to 2010, the percentage for blacks receiving about $9,625,853. Mr. Allen is 0.002%. I repeat that again. The percentage over a nine-year period is 0.202%. The next lowest group are Native Americans at 0.284%. And the most effective group at over $4 billion are, of course, Caucasians.
Wow. Precisely. Yeah.
Yeah, go right ahead, Mr. Chisholm.
So when you look at the number 0.202%, that's less than one-fifth of 1%.
Correct.
In 10 years. So you translate that into opportunities throughout the community for jobs that come out of the construction industry and for highways, roads, and bridges. And now you find out, well, if your community has only gotten less than one-fifth of 1% in the most troubling areas of the city, then where are you supposed to get an opportunity to make a living if you don't have some type of higher education and things of that nature? Because a lot of these jobs are basic, learn on the job kind of opportunity. But even more, I said, well, how do you reconcile this disparity given the fact that the country did not do a good job of developing businesses in these areas because they were not giving contracts prior to the problems that we're having in the American economy? How do you reconcile this disparity in contracts given you say the programs are in compliance? So
let me do this.
Washington.
You're absolutely correct. And Mr. Allen and Mr. Chisholm, let us do this here on point, because I know there are always people that talk in terms that we are not authenticating this kind of information. This information was put out, Mr. Chisholm, and after I give the website, I'd like for you to identify who they are, an entity called Springboard. This specific document with all of this information, figures, percentages, and et cetera, can be found at www.sb501c3-organization.org. Again, www.sb501c3.org. Mr. Allen, is the information, and again, we have to be extremely appreciative of Mr. Chisholm, who, by the way, was removed, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chisholm, from the DOT committee that was supposed to be dealing with good faith efforts and et cetera, because you were raising too many of the wrong questions. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I will say that when they decided that they didn't want me to come back in the room, I had already made the decision that room wasn't effective. And the reason it wasn't, I said, well, why would I keep coming in the room when the person that's giving out the money is our federal government?
Mm-hmm.
If the federal government wants to see that room become more effective, they will at any point, as anybody would, discipline who gets the money, they will make it effective. And so when people say, well, you removed, I said, well, I don't know if I was removed voluntarily by them or voluntarily by myself, but I can definitely tell you that I wasn't going back in the room with those shenanigans anymore.
Now, explain to us and to our listening audiences, Springboard is what kind of group? Who are they? Who is Springboard?
Springboard came into existence to build capacity in the poorest area of Minnesota called North Minneapolis. We knew that if we wanted to change the dynamics, we would first need to find out how to increase the entrepreneurship in the community. One of the factors that we put into play was that governmental contracts were being awarded on the basis of grants that were being awarded for that particular area. Springboard said, well, let's find out how we can stop the flow of that money from just coming in as a pass-through and actually start to create businesses that reside in the community that would be willing to hire the local residents in the community. And
let me ask you a question, Mr. Chisholm. Was Springboard asked to be a presenter at the state at the African American community this morning at North High School?
No, he wasn't, and that was that's rather interesting. But that's I always say we are contrarians to some of the systems that currently go on in North Minneapolis.
Springboard was not asked to be a presenter, and we were talking about opportunities, access, diversity, and et cetera, and your organization was not asked to be a presenter?
No, we were not.
Mr. Edwards, can I interject here real quick?
Go right ahead, sir.
Here's where the issue is that I have a problem with. We have people with documentation that have done the research. Okay, we have three people live on the air right now broadcasting all across the world, the globe. And locally here in the Twin Cities or in North Minneapolis especially, and in our studios, we have, again, I'm going to repeat this, three people that have the documents, the information, and that have done the research. And we want to have a state of the African-American community in Minneapolis. I sat there until I couldn't take it anymore because after the first speaker, Mr. Spike Moss, who did an excellent job, who broke it down, the rest of the people came up and start announcing things that, you know, all three of us, and especially here on the show, me and you, Mr. Edwards, have talked about 2 months ago.
Correct.
And so where was the logic in that? I didn't hear anybody after the first speaker. No one talked about civil rights. And you had people from the city in the audience. You had people from the county in the audience, you know, and it's – if you're going to talk about the state of the African-American community and they're showing up, you point them out, you call them out, and you tell them what's going on. Then you put them folks on the spot. But no one came up there with any documented information to pass out to say, hey, this is what's going on and this is what's happening. But, you know, we kept getting herded. You know, I was there with the media for On Point covering it. And every 5 minutes, someone would come out and say, hey, you need to get back in the auditorium because we're trying to have a show in there. That's exactly, a show. You know, where are the solutions? So.
Absolutely. Mr. Chisholm, where do we go from here? Notice I use the word we because this is our community. These are our people. This is our future. Where do we go from here? What recommendations, what solutions are you and Springboard and others talking about that you can share with us?
The first piece of it. The first part of the solution in order to change the dynamics is to realize that these are governmental programs that are really designed to help the community, but only if the community is willing to demand that the governmental programs work under the civil rights laws that were created back in the 60s. So when I looked at this problem and I said, well, we're going to examine this problem, we have to say the flow of the money is dependent upon our outrage that makes the money stop. If we cannot show how we're going to stop the flow of the money for all, then we're not going to get a chance to participate in this flow of the money. So the solution to the problem is basic what they've done in the 60s. These programs were created because people went in a room and said, we're not going to have this happen without our participation.
Correct. I know I was a part of that kind of discussion and dissent 40 years ago. Go right ahead.
And that nothing has changed. And so we have a lot of people who come in the room who say, well, you can't upset the apple cart. I say, well, the apple cart is who's in the cart. We cannot have the people who are at the table in many cases receiving benefits and taking them right out of the community. And this is happening not just in Minnesota but all across the country. If we look at who controls the land, the vacant land in North Minneapolis, that's primarily controlled by the city. They own the lots.
Uh-huh.
So thus, they control any type of commerce that will come through. And if the local residents, if this was a farming community, if the local residents couldn't plant any crop on the land, then there would be no way to feed the farmers, no way to feed the community. And that's what this has basically come down to. If you don't take control of your community's assets, and this is an asset that comes to the community. They recently redid a road across from the liquor store. The liquor store watched the workers come in the morning, and they watched them leave in the evening. And we asked the question, well, where did the workers reside after they left? None of the workers on that project worked within that community. So the guys going to the liquor store, well, how can you have nothing but despair? They watching someone make $40 an hour in their own community. And the first thing they say is, well, we don't know how you guys can do this. You're not trained. I said, well, I think we built these roads, bridges, et cetera, during one point in time, and now you're telling us we can't do the same thing anymore.
And we did it, by the way, for free.
I think that's what we're really getting at, is that we did it for free. We were okay. We were highly skilled. But now we don't want to do it for free, then now we don't deserve the opportunity.
Absolutely.
And that's what we basically are coming back and saying to the community, is that if the current recipients of the money that are coming through the community are the ones who are electing our representatives to go in and speak for us, then I say, well, we have to do what they did in the 60s and change that representative makeup. And that's all this whole thing is about, is saying if you want to see growth in your community, then, as James Brown said, you gotta stand up. You gotta make that voice known. And when I went and I said, well, what can we do down in Washington? And the reason we went to Washington, because of the simple fact, Washington gives the money out, and Minnesota only can do what Washington tells them to do. And if Washington says, no, you cannot participate in these programs without having active participation by all of these other groups involved, Asians, African-American, Hispanics, Latinos, Somalians, Hmongs, then we are not going to keep giving you the money. And that was the question that I put before them. What
in Washington, D.C., at this meeting.
In Washington, D.C.,
right.
On the House side and the Senate side.
Right.
I said, what does it take to rule one of these programs in noncompliance of the civil rights laws of 1964 so that all people can participate? And the answer came back overwhelmingly, we have been stripped of those enforcements through legislative actions and also rulings out of the Supreme Court over the last 20 to 25 years.
Right. Now, let me ask you the question again. We asked it earlier at this. What is the position of our federal Congress representatives from the 4th and 5th Congressional District, McCollum in St. Paul, Keith Ellison in Minneapolis? I mean, obviously, I think I asked you the question early on that they facilitated this meeting, and then you corrected me by indicating that they really didn't have any real part of it. But obviously, the tenor and then the information that flowed out of this meeting that you and others from our community, from our enclaves here, brought forward, the two congressional offices I know are talking in terms of both assistance and will raise these questions within the framework of the Congress. Is this correct, or am I overstating something, or what?
Well, let me say how this came about once we got there. Congressman Oberstar's office called Keith Ellison's office, Congressman Ellison's office, and said, we're having a meeting with one of the constituents out of your community. Would you like to come and sit in on the meeting?
Oh, okay. All right. And what happened then?
Congressman Ellison sent one of his constituents to the meeting. One of his aides to the meeting.
Okay.
We have not been assisted by Congressman Ellison in this regard. Springboard hasn't. I can't speak for other organizations, but Springboard hasn't been assisted through any efforts of Congressman Ellison at this time.
I see.
Congressman McCollum's office has been very receptive in talking with us. Because she has a light rail project coming down our area.
Yes, she
does. And it's $989 million.
Mm-hmm.
So
down University
right
Avenue,
now,
right.
Yeah, Central Corridor Project. Mm-hmm. So it's to that community's best interest that she assists in this endeavor. because if they build that light rail and nobody works on that project, it becomes the old project of that built 94. It just ran through and nobody got anything out of it.
Okay.
So her office has been more receptive to speaking with us and helping in our endeavor than Congressman Ellison's office. And I saw Congressman Ellison that morning at the National Association of Minority Contractors Congressional Breakfast.
Oh, he was in Washington then. He was not here in the home district. He was in Washington. And again, you saw him that morning at a breakfast. Go ahead.
I said good morning to him. He said good morning to me. And the meeting was after the breakfast ended. We just walked upstairs at the Rayburn Building. So the question becomes, well, if your staff was there, you could, come to the meeting. You were in the area. I don't, hold him and say, well, maybe he had something else scheduled. I don't know. We didn't ask him to the meeting because we haven't got any assistance from him currently.
Right.
So the question becomes, can we get assistance from the other members of the Congressional Black Caucus, which are in the only member that sits on the committee, Transportation Committee, is Congressman Elijah Cummings,
out of Maryland. Is that correct?
Out of Maryland.
Yeah, Congressman Cummings, out of Maryland. Okay.
So
he's a very senior member, too, by the way.
Absolutely.
So when we
presented the report to him, he called one of his staff members over immediately and said,
ooh,
talk to them. Because we pointed out that this program has to be looked at for compliance issues. And he called one of his staff members over immediately in an open area, and we talked to them for the longest. We also talked with Senator Burris, who is the only African-American senator we have.
Democrat, Illinois. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we talked with them immediately about the issue. They scheduled a meeting for us, and we talked to them. We went over to Senator Boxer's committee in the Senate side, which handles the same responsibility as the Congressman Oberstar's side on the House.
Democrat, California.
We sit down and talk with her, her people immediately.
Their
senior people. So the question becomes, if we're raising the question, I think we're going to have to take the issue in other areas so that more people become aware of just the significance. But Minnesota is the only one that we've literally been able to compile the data to show the participation. We have been searching for the data from North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and we're just beginning to get some remnants of the data from Oregon,
mm-hmm,
because they have a big program up there that they're doing a lot of work through.
I do understand that there's a young lady at the South Dakota Department of Transportation. I heard this. In fact, we had this. Mr. Allen, if you remember, came across doing a telephone call in out of South Dakota. There is a young lady in the South Dakota Department of Transportation that has been fairly helpful. And, in fact, it allowed us on that program, Mr. Allen, about nine weeks ago to indicate that percentage-wise, South Dakota has done better with minorities than the state of Minnesota.
Until we get the data, I'm gonna go with her. I'm gonna say she is.
Yeah.
And I never question them. I say, well, just do like I asked. Let's audit your data, and we all can have a good answer.
Okay.
We can verify or not verify your answer.
Anything else for Mr. Chisholm?
One quick question that we want our listeners to know about too here. Those numbers and I've seen documentation there, and I actually have a copy here that Mr. Chisholm is talking about. I think those were baseline numbers. Now you get into a whole different stratosphere when you talk about the updates and the revisions and the add-ons and et cetera to those different contracts. So we're looking at a huge amount. Not that amount that Mr. Chisholm has now is huge, but we're looking at a huge amount that has not been in compliance. They have not hired the minority ethnic community, and they continue to run into walls. And it's a shame, but at some point, someone's gonna have to pull the plug on them. Period.
Right. But still, I want to thank you again for taking time to share with us your experiences, and particularly your experience in Washington, D.C. I know there are some aspects of what you have indicated that I know are troubling to Mr. Allen and myself, and, of course, we will editorialize it on that. We have the prerogative of the constitutional right to do that, and we certainly will. We want to thank
First
you once
Amendment.
Again for sharing the information.
Well, I want to thank you guys for having me on the show again. And anytime I get a chance to come on here, I think your listeners get one more opportunity to hear another side. And you guys keep bringing that that other side. We all things need to be heard, not just what they say is the best message, but all messages. And I appreciate you guys once again.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chisholm. Thank you.
And Mr. Allen, looks like again we're a little bit beyond pointless. Let me give that figure again. That has been captured by the Springboard Group, which is a local entity right here in our own city of Minneapolis. In the period from 2001 to 2010, African Americans have received from the Minnesota Department of Transportation out of $4,774,636,385,000 have received a percentage of 0.202%.
Yes. And it seems like we're hovering here a lot around the civil rights issues. And before we move on, Ms. Edwards, I would like to give our listeners, and especially Mustafa out there who's listening, an opportunity to call in. Our toll-free number is 1-877-572-4288. Again, you can call in on our toll-free number. It's 1-877-572-4288.
Thank you, Mr. Allen.
You're welcome, sir. One of the things that was really shocking to me on this past Tuesday here, I had went into the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights to file a complaint against a community organization, the Jordan Area Community Council, for the simple fact that the vice chair runs a blog that is uses racial comments toward African Americans. The vice chair of the Jordan Area Community Council has a blog that calls black people thug huggers and black women thuggerinas. And he also made a statement that rats were better than black people because rats knew who their mothers and fathers were, talking
yes.
about his neighbors next door. This 300-pound Caucasian male who will not talk to you in public is the vice chair of the Jordan Area Community Council. His chairman happens to be the director of the investigation unit at the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, and his name is Michael Kip Brown. So I got a little disgusted and went down to the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights as a private citizen concerned about the civil rights of the community and filed a claim. Well, Mr. Edwards, on yesterday, via registered mail, I received a letter from a secretary, Monica Diaz, who looks like now she's the intake officer, administrative analyst number two.
Mm-hmm.
And the letter said, thank you for taking the time to complete the intake process at our office. I have reviewed the information you provided me in connection with your request to file a charge of discrimination against Jordan Area Community Council, a professional organization on the basis of race, as well as reprisal claim. Unfortunately, as I indicated to you when we met yesterday, which was 9/21, our office will be unable to process your complaint because of conflict of interest.
Mr. Allen, on this particular point, this greatly disturbs me, and obviously to our listening audience, Mr. Allen and I have discussed this. This is the first time that he has read me the letter in its totality. We wanted to be as transparent as possible. I am troubled by the declarations by Ms. Monica Diaz, who actually started out as a temp in the Civil Rights Department and then became a receptionist. She said, I want to be absolutely clear and transparent, is she said to you that she had reviewed your request or your attempt to file a complaint. Am I correct?
And I quote from Ms. Diaz, I have reviewed the information you provided to me in connection with your request to file a charge.
All right. That's good enough for us here. Here's the problem. And in the next number of minutes, we will also talk in terms of a second conflict of interest issue that did not receive disclosure, that was uncovered by Mr. Allen and others. First of all, the ordinance, but more importantly, the canons of law require that a determination of that nature be done by a person who is a legal practitioner. In this country, legal practitioner means an attorney at law properly certified by the courts. Ms. Diaz is none of those things. In fact, I am not sure that she even has a high school equivalency. The action that she makes reference to, that she made a determination relevant to the issue of conflict of interest, is a matter that has to be reviewed in consultation with the executive director, Ms. Velma Quaval, and the city attorney's office. Now, there has already been a violation of state law by the declaration by Ms. Diaz that she has determined that there was a conflict of interest, okay? This bothers me because there is a situation involving the death of a young African-American at the hands of police here in the city of Minneapolis at the YMCA, in which Ms. Velma Quaval has a serious conflict of interest and forgot to mention when she rejected a request by a group of community organizations for an investigation into the death of David Cornelius Smith. She forgot to mention that she, Ms. Velma Quaval, is a member of the Y's board of directors, and they have made a determination that they will squash the investigation. Now, I am confused, Mr. Allen, by the inconsistencies as it pertains to the doctrine of conflict of interest. Can you help me any kind of way on this?
Well, I can help you a little bit. One thing that they neglected to bring into play here is where they're busted, and I'm going to have an announcement to make after this, is USC 1983, federal civil rights violation, in short, depriving one of their constitutional rights while acting under the color of law. Okay?
Correct.
Title 42, Chapter 21, Subchapter 1, 1983. Civil rights action for deprivation of...
and deprived.
Right. It says, every person who, under color of any statute, ordinance, regulation, custom, or usage of any state or territory in the District of Columbia, subjects or causes to be subjected in any citizen of the United States and other person within the jurisdiction of thereof, to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, immunities, securities, and constitutional laws, shall be liable to the party injured in the action at law, suit, in equity, or other proper proceedings to redress, excerpt in that action brought against the judicial officer for an act or commission taken in such officer's judicial capacity. Okay? What they've done here is they've created a juggernaut, as we say, Mr. Edwards, for themselves by letting a secretary with no legal experience at all whatsoever say that she investigated, she determined that was a conflict of interest.
I mean, clearly, what we said just minutes ago, I mean, this is extremely disturbing and raises the question of a felony offense.
Yes,
by the Department of Civil Rights in the name of law and under color of law, and I'm shocked, and I will be shocked, if a city attorney, Susan Siegel, does not have the guts to order that, first of all, that letter and determination be withdrawn. That's first and foremost.
Yes.
And that there be an appropriate review of what has happened here, because that is a clear violation of the law. You have read some of the statutes. There are additional statutes. There are probably any number of lawyers who are listening to this program that are just dying to have you retain them as counsel, okay? But I'm saying to you, sir, as one who helped draft the civil rights ordinance of this city over 40-some years ago, that Ms. Diaz, who I'm not sure, by the way, if Ms. Diaz is a naturalized American citizen, okay?
Yeah.
And there's a whole issue as it pertains to a foreigner being involved in this kind of determination under color of American law. This is just absolutely outrageous. And then this coming on the heels of Ms. Quaval failing to declare a true conflict of interest by being a member of the board of the YMCA and rejecting the request made by a number of organizations, including organizations that both the hosts of this program On Point are members of, and indicated that there would be no civil rights review of the circumstances leading to the death by taser by Minneapolis police on the sixth floor of the YMCA on the 9th of September 2010 that there would be no review, yet she should have at least had the guts, and I'm talking about Ms. Carvell, who had indicated that conflict of interest would be the prima facie in this situation also. This is what we live under. This is the kind of yoke of terror and tyranny that we reside under as African-Americans and others of color in these Twin Cities, my friends.
Yes, but Mr. Edwards, we have a caller.
Okay. Go right ahead.
Hello, caller. You're live on Point. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Mustafa calling from Minneapolis.
Yes, Mustafa, you had called last week at the end of the show, and I'm glad we can reach out to you and get you to call back in here. What's happening?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As I mentioned last week, I'm a listener and a reader of your articles, and I'm always interested to share with you whenever you bring these kind of problems that you are having, that we have the same problems. And I'm originally from Africa, Somalia,
mm-hmm.
and we always need your help, people like you, to help us. Police abuse. Basically, this is what is going on. They apply. When they're dealing with the Somalis or African immigrants, they act like they are another country. They don't even use. They use different laws. That's what I'm thinking, because otherwise they wouldn't do what they're doing, you know. And they take advantage of people, you know, because they're not familiar with how the system works or how to defend themselves. And plus they have all these people that they give them taxpayers' money. They call Somali leaders, who are there just to mislead the community. Every time there's issue, they come to those people and they just mislead the people.
As I mentioned
last week, we have over 80 non-profit organizations in Minneapolis.
I know what the gentleman is referring to. One of the things he's referring to, Mr. Allen, was the tragic shooting of a Somali cab driver on Golden Valley Road a little over a year ago. And it was quite interesting how the Minneapolis Police Department, the city of Minneapolis, and the mayor circumvented a meaningful investigation in the way that they handled the Somali leadership. In fact, I attended a meeting at the high-rise in St. Paul that same week, and I heard a passionate plea from the Somali community, including the deceased, his relatives and mother, and et cetera. Unfortunately, it never happened. By the way, when it finally went to a grand jury, it was a year and a half later, just about as bad as the situation with Quincy Smith, and, of course, the grand jury returned no bill. In that case, that Somali gentleman in the cab was shot at least 14 times. So, we understand. We say this to the caller. We have another particular piece that we want to do that I think will augment him. Maybe he will give us a call back after we conclude, Mr. Allen. We can get some pertinent information and maybe sit down with him in person. Okay?
Yes.
All right.
Hey,
all right.
Mustafa, I'm going to get in touch with you. Mustafa is also my friend on Facebook, and we stay in contact almost every day. So we're set up a meeting where we can sit down and go over there and talk to them and get the firsthand information, get it out there. Okay, Mustafa?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Allen, let me just say in support of what Mustafa has just said, I call your attention to yesterday's edition of the New York Times in the business section of all places that talks in terms of the significant increase in discrimination against Muslims in this country in at least 9 separate categories, including race, religion, national origin, the areas of jobs, and et cetera. yesterday's edition, New York Times, for those that are really interested, for those that are concerned about social justice, need to get yesterday's copy of the New York Times, a significant piece, probably over about 5,000 words, so you know it was pretty conclusive, pretty big.
Yeah,
it kind of gives you an insight into what is happening to our brothers and sisters in the Muslim community, but they are fighting back, and so I want to do that in support. Mr. Allen, I kind of cut in on you. Additionally, what has happened? I mean, this letter has now been sent to you, sir. I mean, what action are you contemplating that you can share with our audience?
Well, first of all, on that last subject you just talked about, the discrimination against the Muslims, if folks want to find that, the title of the story is Muslims Report Rising Discrimination at Work, and it's in the New York Times, and it'll come right up. You just Google that topic or that title. I just want to let folks know. My plan, first of all, Mr. Edwards, is to actually I'm going to write an open letter to Michael Kit Brown and also to Velma Corbell. And I'm asking to use the USC 1983, the law against discrimination and being excluded or deprived of it, and show and build a case online publicly for their peers to see on why this secretary has determined in her case, or in this case, that is a conflict of interest. Then I plan on instituting the help of the Jordan Hawkman, who is a watchdog group in North Minneapolis, in delivering some of this information out onto the web and make it public and demand an explanation with the statutes of why this is okay.
I think, sir, that is excellent. It certainly needs to happen, but I would certainly encourage my co-host to contact Susan Siegel, the city attorney, and request under color of law, always an important word, important reference, that she sit in on a meeting. I, in fact, Don, would ask for a meeting, which would include the city attorney, so that Ms. Corbell and Mr. Brown and others can indicate what the protocol is within the Civil Rights Department that is consistent with the requirements of the law that allows the secretary to write a letter indicating she conducted an investigation and has reached a determination which requires knowledge of a body of law that I'm quite sure, as I said before, I'm not even sure that Ms. Diaz, by the way, is a American citizen. You really need to do that, Don. You really need to do that. And hopefully some of the leaders that are always talking in terms of let's work together, let's sit down, will give you a call at the conclusion of this program this afternoon and ask to at least join you in this situation. As we certainly came out in support of the position, though we were out front before they were, on the gang task force situation, in which is the role of Mike Freeman, and definitely the tragedy involving David Cornelius Smith, 28-year-old African-American who was tasered to death on the gym floor at the YMCA downtown Minneapolis on the sixth floor, in which Ms. Corbell has actively moved to obstruct an examination under the Minneapolis Civil Rights Ordinance of the circumstances of David Cornelius Smith's death. I think we owe it to the family and to loved ones and to the proposition of justice.
Yes, and you know, speaking of the deceased Mr. David Cornelius Smith, we did a lot of research on this Monday, the 20th of September, trying to make contact with the YMCA.
Yes, we did.
And nationally, and to our listening audience, and I'm not even kidding you, we've called almost every number to the Chicago USA YMCA, which is the head office. We've called downtown Minneapolis, and you can't get really anyone. Well, let me just put it like this. When the folks answer the phone, the person you need to talk to is in the meeting. And as far as the national goes, no one ever answered the phone one time.
Also, we traced, to our listening audience, we traced the vice president of communications for the Minneapolis YMCA to Vancouver, Canada, where she allegedly was at a conference. We left messages for her at the hotel. In fact, we started really, and we should have gone ahead and done that, and that was to have called Canadian Immigration / Customs and indicated there was a serious message for her. Also, for our listening audience, we attempted all day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, to contact the American Civil Liberties Union. They have declined to return our calls. Our question to them was, had they completed their examination, as was publicly cited in the September 12th edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, that they were conducting an investigation along with the NAACP. We can't even find a telephone number for the NAACP here in Minneapolis.
Speaking, you just said something. The NAACP. I talked with the president, Mr. Booker Hodges, today. And I asked him point blank. I said, what are you going to do about this David Cornelius Smith who was tased to death by the Minneapolis police and the YMCA? I said, you're going to launch some kind of campaign? You go, well, you know, they're going to get a lawyer, and we'll support him. What's his answer?
They're going to get a lawyer. We're going to support him.
Yeah, he says their family's going to get a lawyer.
I mean, yeah, but that's not what they said when they issued a press release through their vice president, Brian Smith, and made great claims along with the Civil Liberties Union that they intended to initiate a vigorous investigation into the death at the hands of Minneapolis police of David Cornelius Smith. That's not what they said. But that's what they're saying now. Okay, gotcha. I hear you. By the way, Don, if I could, let me also, this goes back to Mike Patton, and okay. We did this about a month ago. The embarrassment for the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, Mr. Allen, is at page 14 of the brief or the opinion issued by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. It was submitted on May 12, 2010. Filed on August 12, 2010, by the three-judge panel. Go to page 14 of their opinion, and you will see one of the most egregious judicial errors in the modern history of the Eighth Circuit. And with Mr. Patton providing the information which has been suppressed by all of our major news organizations, I personally, who have written about this, and we have talked about this here on Point, I can understand that once the entire court of the Eighth Circuit came together, read columns, okay, and realized that if a community layperson can recognize the significant judiciary error by a three-member appellate panel, then clearly the Supreme Court and the rest of the justices of the Eighth Circuit recognized it. And what that issue was, Mr. Allen, we repeat it again as we first laid it out 8 weeks ago. In their opinion, upholding the verdict of an all-white jury in the federal court in May of 2009, they cited the existence of video evidence that was never introduced at trial. And if it does exist, which it did at one point, would actually show Officer Jason Anderson shooting Fong Lee three times in the back as he fell, twisted and fell onto his back. Will show Jason Anderson walking up to him, shooting him five more times in the chest, and it will show that about 11 minutes later that police officers of the Minneapolis Police Department who arrived on the scene realized there was no weapon, and the video would show them planting the gun. Mm. That's what's at play with respect to this decision by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals to reverse itself and indicate that they will not conduct an evidentiary hearing and allow new information. And by the way, I can appreciate what Mr. Patton has to do. I mean, that's his living. He's an attorney at law. I have to tell you, Mr. Allen, I don't think there's any way that the United States Supreme Court will review this particular issue.
It would be nice to try to get a hold of them tapes. I know that's virtually impossible, but, you know, this guy, I mean, they didn't find one drop of his blood on the weapon that was laying next to him.
No blood, no fingerprints, no fiber. You know, we're great in this country with respect to CSI and all these television programs. We're telling you that we can find any fiber. We can find a flicker of dry skin off your hands, buddy, and we can use that DNA. In the case of the gun, that was allegedly found about a foot and a half away from the what would have been the left hand of the deceased Fong Lee. There was not a shred of anything. I mean, when you have a instrument, in this case a gun, that doesn't have any fiber or DNA. See, Fong Lee's DNA was not on that gun.
No.
Okay, his DNA was not on the gun, all right? And one of the reasons was is that in the course of planting the gun, it, the officers realized it was too difficult for them to take a chance of being seen taking the gun. Normally what you do is take the gun, the weapon, and you place it in the individual's hand, and that gets enough DNA that you'll be able to protect yourself later on down the line. Are you understand? Are you following me?
Yes, oh yes.
Okay. In this specific case, because of the existence of the cameras, and they were not sure that they would be able to control the obtaining of the videotapes and sanitize it, there was no officer there who was willing to take the gun and attempt to put the DNA from Fong Lee onto the weapon, because that would also bring into play the possibility of DNA from at least the first five officers who were at the scene. Not including or excluding the State Highway Patrolman, Officer Bentz, Jason Anderson, and the first three police officers who arrived there in which the gun was taken from the trunk of one of their cars. And on that particular point, Mr. Allen, the Eighth Circuit, realizing what had happened, refused to reverse itself.
Yeah.
I mean, this is – it's frightening. I mean, it's a reenactment of the novel –
1984. Oh yes, yeah, they have an uphill battle with what's going on with the Fong Lee case, the shooting, the tasing of Mr. David Cornelius Smith, and the non-movement, or just, I mean, how do you get a civil rights private even to get active in something like this? I mean, would this happen in Atlanta or New York or Chicago?
It may not even happen in some smaller enclaves, you know, Sioux City, Iowa, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. You know what I'm saying, sir? Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
There, you know, Keokuk, Iowa. There may be people there that would not allow this to happen. But here, our community leadership is so intimidated and fearful, quote unquote, of the heavy hand and the heavy whip of the massa that it happens here. And we challenge anybody to confront us on what we have just said on these particular issues. You know, call in. Feel free to call in and raise questions to us relevant to the material facts. Notice the word we use, material facts, that we have laid out here just on these particular matters, you know. We've got what, Mr. Allen, about 10
minutes left, and we got some general housekeeping announcements to make and some things like that. So if you want, we can go into that right now.
Let's give the number one more time. Maybe
okay,
we
sure.
have someone that maybe said, you know, is wants to give us a call.
Anybody with a question, dial 1-877-572-4288. Again, that toll-free number is 1-877-572-4288, and those of you locally, or if you that line is busy, you can dial 1-347-426-3904.
All right.
I just wanted
to thank Mr. Chisholm, by the way, because
oh, yeah.
that to me that was just some phenomenal information he shared with our listening audience, both domestic and international.
Yeah, it was. I'm glad he could call in and let us know what's going on. Also, I'd just like to remind our listeners that on October 5th, a couple Tuesdays away, we're going to be, you and I, Mr. Edwards, we'll be moderating and hosting the Minnesota 5th Congressional District debate on Minneapolis Television Network at 7 p.m. And it's MTN. If you live in Minneapolis, you'll be able to view it live because it will be a live broadcast. But you're also, if you don't live in Minneapolis, you'll be able to listen to it live on Point. We'll be doing a simulcast during the same time that we're doing the Minnesota 5th Congressional District debate. We have confirmed stateswoman Lynn Torgelson, Michael Kavlan, independent progressive, and Thomas Schrunk, who is with the Independence Party.
Okay.
I meet with the Republican Party on Monday at 1:30.
to get a final answer from there. But we know already right now that Congressman Keith Ellison is declining the invitation and saying that he has to be in Congress on October 5th. And we do have people out in the field confirming that. And I did meet with his scheduler actually today. I talked with her at length this morning, and we might, you know, get lucky of having the presence of the congressman. Either way it goes, he'll be there, because either he'll be there in person or we will have a cutout there of him.
Okay.
So that
let me just indicate that one of the issues certainly that we would like to hear from the congressman on, because it deals with homeland security, it deals with international security, it deals with international foreign policy. It would be important that we not be remiss and not point out that many of the world leaders have been in New York at the United Nations for its annual fall confab. You know, the world's leaders come, get up on the podium and talk about what they want to talk about. Of course, as we all know, Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, has been the center of attraction, and as well as, to somewhat a lesser degree, President Barack Obama. President Barack Obama, by the way, the statistics are showing, interesting enough, that the Tea Party and conservative Republicans have driven up the percentage of Americans who now say that President Barack Obama is a foreigner and a Muslim, and consequently is not legally suited, nor legally should he be president of the United States. I mean, that is just some outrageous kinds of accusations and et cetera. But we certainly would like to talk to the congressman about the future of the Middle East. He has been identified, Mr. Allen, as an expert on the Middle East, particularly given that he's one of two Muslims in the United States House of Representatives and by extension the Congress. And I certainly would like to hear from him on the 5th some of his reflections on what's going to happen, particularly in closing on the fact that Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel has indicated that the moratorium on the building of settlements and et cetera will renew, and the Palestinians have indicated if that happens, they have no choice but to walk away from the peace negotiations that President Barack Obama worked so hard to put in place. There have been a couple of sessions. There were a couple in Washington. There have been a couple in Cairo. But now Netanyahu is saying that he has no intention and that they will continue to build settlements and push Palestinians out of territory that has already been created to them. I'd really like to hear Congressman Ellison's observations on that. Wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would love to hear that. I'd like him to break it on down for us, because besides the Department of Transportation and that, you know, we got a lot going on there that we're not really hearing a peep out of. You know, or about,
right, and I'm just not understanding. I mean, I know he's in a safe election. I mean, I know it looks like he'll probably get 62-63% of the vote, you know, on the first Tuesday in November. I mean, I'm just not understanding, other than maybe there's a certain level of arrogance and comfort that makes him feel that it's not necessary to respond to that. But in light of that, I wish then that he would spend more time at home, because clearly if he's that comfortable with what's going on in the Middle East, then he doesn't need to do all those fact findings, does he?
No, not at all. No. That might not be fact finding. That might be money gathering, since over 80% of his contributions come from outside of the state of Minnesota.
Well, you know, I told you that's what the Jerusalem Post has said in an article last year, and we certainly had invited Congressman Ellison to refute that, to let us know if that's a fact, how he feels about that. But if we can't get him to show up, you know, we got nothing but an empty chair. I mean, what can we do? By the way, quick sports question for you: do you think the Vikings will become 0-3 on Sunday?
Oh yeah, you know what, this is one of the years, Mr. Edwards, you know me, and I watch some sports. I like playing it, going to the gym, but not really watching it on TV. And this year I said, okay, I'm going to be with the Vikings, because they did such a great job last year. After this second game, I mean, I don't care if the TV does not even hit a football channel, okay? I'm done.
You're that depressed. See, there you go. You joined so many other of the Viking stalwarts, if you will. Detroit is probably the team that the Vikings need to play before their bye week to get them at least to 1-2. Because, boy, I'm telling you, if you look at their schedule after the bye week, for the Vikings to start talking about playing the Giants and the Jets and Baltimore, well, and the Packers in Chicago, and they're coming off of the bye week 0-3. I have said on my television program, I've said the best I'm expecting from the Vikings is 10-6. If they lose Sunday, I'm going to downgrade that to 8-8 at best.
Well, at least give them 500%, huh?
Yeah. I'll have to drop it to 8-8. I mean, I'm talking initially. I thought 10-6 because I knew that Brett Favre. That was a fantastic year he had last year. The gods of Olympus poured all kinds of water of youth on his body. But it's not going to happen again. But I thought that Brad Childress would do a better job of being able to coach, which apparently he's not. And there is dissension in the Viking locker room after the fiasco dealing with getting Brett to come back and the three wise men, white wise men, who were sent to go down to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, to say, come on, Brett, come on back and play and help run the team. And it was just such a disrespect to the very fine black leadership on that team. The Williamses, Winfield, Adrian Peterson, and other. And those brothers really have to be seething. They may not say it openly. You know, they're agents. You know, you need to maintain your livelihood. But you can see it, Don, in the body language. And I've said this to you over the last 4 or 5 weeks. You can see it in the body language. And so just, hey, for the Viking faithful out here, I just hope that your team is able to come off of the conclusion of the game Sunday, 1-2, you know. And not join the Minnesota Gophers who play later on tonight who are getting ready to probably be 1-3. But anyways, hey, that's just sports, Don. What the heck?
Yeah, that's what it is. Well, we want to remind everybody, you had mentioned it, to tune in to Minneapolis Television Network Channel 17 tomorrow, Sunday, the 26th of September at 5 p.m. for your show, Black Focus, an hour-long show that you're going to have on Minneapolis Television Network. Again, that's Channel 17 tomorrow. And your weekly column in the Minneapolis or Minnesota Spokesman Recorder comes out every week here, delivered all over the cities.
And by the way, both on in both formats, we're talking about the death of David Cornelius Smith.
Okay, so that would be the
all
topic.
Right.
All right, and don't forget to read the Independent Business News Network. That's IBNNnews.com, where I will be posting the open letter to Ms. Velma Corbell and Mr. Michael Gift Brown.
And please, Don, if you would, be sure to print the response from Ms. Diaz.
Oh, yes. That's going to be – I took a picture of the letter just to put it in the post. So
thank you.
I didn't want to retype it or touch it up on the original thing. So with that said, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week at 4 p.m. We invite all our listeners to come on back, and maybe next week we'll have we will have some guest schedules, and we'll let you know about midweek who's going to be coming on. And you can always participate by calling our toll-free number. Again, thank you for listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.